This is the first shiur in Rav Dessler's Neis V'Teva. As I mentioned, we started the first series of Rav Dessler, and here it's even more true. Rav Dessler presents ideas in a very simple fashion, simple and direct. And it's worthwhile to think carefully about what he says, to think of objections. Often, given the simplicity of his presentation, you could think of objections. But if you push hard, you'll see that his presentation is not affected by the objections, that really, if you look carefully at what he says, there's a way to see how the objection should be answered. Now this section is entitled Neis V'Teva, Miracle and Nature. What's driving the discussion is the following simple problem. If you ask a person, what is a miracle? The natural answer is, a miracle is a break in nature. Nature is running the world almost all the time, and a miracle is when you have a break in nature. That answer is helpful, informative, enlightening, to the extent that you know what nature is. If there's some serious problem about what nature is, to be told that a miracle is a break in nature is not very helpful. What nature is a gigantic problem. Philosophy has been struggling with that problem for, certainly in all of modern philosophy, since Descartes in the last 350 years, and by implication even earlier, it's a gigantic problem. So if you don't know what nature is, then you really don't know what a miracle is if you're told that a miracle is just a break in nature. That's why Rav Dessler entitles his section Neis V'Teva, Miracle of Nature, because he wants to show us that one plays off the other and that understanding nature is a serious problem. He will explain to us what nature really is, and then we will be able to understand what a miracle is, and will have an entirely different implication from other possible understandings of what nature are. I will translate for you what he says, and then we will discuss it. What is the difference between miracle and nature? After all, aren't both of them produced by God? Rav Dessler starting from a religious point of view. He's a religious philosopher. They're both produced by God. So why does one deserve one title and the other deserves another title? For this question, many of our brothers, fellow believers, will make fun of us, and they will say, of course, everyone knows that everything comes from God, but nature is what God set as a law in the creation, that it should behave with a certain limited nature via cause and effect. I shouldn't have said limited nature. I've used the word nature twice. In a limited fashion, a fashion that's limited by certain rules, categories, possibilities, and it's characterized by cause and effect. And that's the way the world runs. It runs by these patterns of cause and effect. However, sometimes, due to a great necessity, for someone who has great merits, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will go out of the limitations that he made. He made those limitations. And he does open miracles that are not subject to cause and effect. The event that takes place doesn't have a cause. Breaks the pattern of cause and effect. And that's what the miracles were in the Tanakh, and that we have in the writings of the sages. Breaches in the pattern of cause and effect. So here, the first answer to the question is, nature is cause and effect, and miracles break the order of cause and effect. That's stage one. Now, Rav Dessler says, and if we shall return and ask them, what is cause and effect? What is cause and effect? What kind of a thing is it? What kind of a reality is it? What kind of an existence is it? How is it? Listen to his question. Lama, why or how is it that the effect comes out of the cause? This is the question he wants an answer to. I know that this is the cause, and I know that that's the effect. But how does the effect come out of the cause? Why is it that when this cause occurs, that effect comes out of it? For example, what is it that causes the growth of plants? Tavua, crops. If we'll ask them this, what is cause and effect? Why or how does the effect come from the cause? What is it that makes plants grow? They will answer us, it's obvious. With respect to the plants, because you prepared the ground by plowing it, and afterwards you put the seeds in it, and then you put the water on it, that's all you need. There I've given you a list of all the causes, natural causes, that cause the growth of the crops. And if we'll continue to ask, says Rav Dessler, why do these causes give rise to the growth of the crops? I didn't ask you for a list of the causes. I asked you for the connection between the cause and the effect. I know which things you have to do to make the crops grow. I know from experience. I know that if you don't water it, it won't grow. I know that if you plant it in the wrong season, it won't grow. I know that if you put the seed on top of hard ground, typically it's not going to grow. You have to plow the ground. I know all that. What I want to know is, after you've made a list of all the causes and you've told me what the effect is, how does the effect come out of the cause? So he says, if I insist on that question, they will again make fun of us and they'll say, look, you can see with your eyes that that's how it always is. Whenever you put you plow the ground and plant the seed and water it at the right time in the sunlight, then the plants grow. You see that of necessity, all these things are causes which God established in the world as a law, a fixed law, that these causes will give rise to these effects. And that's what nature is. Now, I hope you feel that there's been a bit of a disconnect here. Rav Dessler is pushing a question, and he's not really getting answers to the question. You want to say something?
This is without getting into details of scientific, because of how wood actually makes a seed decompose and regrow.
Good. So now, the first natural thought is, all of this is on the surface. Surely, if we go to the scientific explanation, which goes at a much deeper level, we'll get an answer to the question. That's perfect. We'll go into that in detail. That is a natural response to what he's saying, and we'll go into that in detail. Good. That was one of the objections which should pop to mind. And that'll be the answer, but we'll have to see that in detail. Well, let me go a little bit further into into the next paragraph. And then we'll answer that question among others. But that's good. That's the way to think about Rav Dessler. But what about a scientific explanation? However, says Rav Dessler, if we'll be more precise and go deeper, the question will stand before us. We still don't know the process by which the cause causes the effect. All we've been told so far is, when you assemble all these causes, then you get that effect. And that's the way it always is. But I'm asking for the guts of it. I'm asking for the inner reality. When you assemble all the causes, and you see the effect come out, what's the bridge between the two of them? Now, those of you who have secular education, I'm saying this for the recording, and who have the name David Hume ringing in your mind, that's the right name to ring. It's the right name to ring. He's asking exactly Hume's question here. So Rav Dessler says, you haven't explained to me how the effect comes from the cause. All you've told me is we know that that's the way it always happens. Well, he says, to say that it always happens just means that we become used to it. We become accustomed to it. We've formed a kind of habit in our minds because we see that that's what always happens. If that's true, he says, consider the following case. Imagine that in our world, a different world, imaginary world, when someone dies and you bury him, and the body decomposes, that after a certain period of time, slowly, slowly, from the depths of the grave, they would start to grow the body of a person. And it would grow and rise up through the ground, and the grave would open, and it would, the body, the person would come out and stand up alive like all the living. Suppose that happened always. People die?
Doesn't have a neshama.
Huh? One second. I'm talking about what you see. This is what you see. You bury the person, body decomposes, 10 years later, starts to reassemble, and then it's reliable. You know, he died on January 5th, 2002. January 5th, 2012, remember to be there with the party and the, you know, the balloons and the drinks, because he's coming back at 2012. And it happens on schedule every time. What would we say . Isn't this really the resurrection of the dead? And yet, what do we say? We would say, well, that's the way it happens always. Since that's what we said for everything else, we would regard it as natural. Now, what happens when you put a seed in the ground? The seed first starts to decompose. And once it decomposes, then it germinates and becomes a new plant. Why don't we call that a miracle? It's really a very similar process. It starts to decompose and then a new plant grows out of it. Isn't the difference only that in our world, this happens to every seed all the time? So we get used to it and we can predict it, and therefore we call it nature. And in our world, it doesn't happen to people, so if we saw it happen once, we'd say, wow, that's a great miracle. Why? Because the rest of the time it doesn't happen. Isn't the difference only between what happens regularly or doesn't happen regularly? And that means that all you have when you're trying to explain cause and effect is that this happens regularly and that doesn't happen regularly. That's all you have. There's nothing more to it. There's no explanation of how the cause gives rise to the effect. You just know that they're associated this way. Which was, in fact, Hume's position, at least according to one way of reading Hume. Like every great philosopher, there's at least six different ways of reading him. So according to one way of reading Hume, that was his position. All cause and effect is when you have a regular association of certain events with other events. That's what Rav Dasa says. Yeah.
Why can't you? I'm not sure if this is what these people who Rav Dasa is trying to counter are saying, but it's kind of sense of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made nature. He did create nature, but he created nature in the sense of that he created it, that it's not a hands-on thing, that it's not a Mechadosh B'Tuvi B'Chol Yom Tov, but it's the fact that he set it up when he created the world. He created it. This is the way it's going to be running. And God created that as much as there is scientific explanation for what makes the seed decompose, it's really Hashem doing it. But Hashem is not actually doing it by each and every seed. He did it when Hashem created the world. He made it that from now on, this is going to always happen.
Okay, you're asking why can't we say, and I think you're right, this is what people who's asking the question too will say, that God set it up that the world works this way, which of course means that when it happens, he did it, but how did he do it? He did it by setting up the world to work this way regularly through laws that take care of themselves.
It's amazing, he's going to actually be doing it right then.
With resurrection of the dead, he'll be doing it himself right away, you know, immediately when the event takes place. I think that's right. I think that we have to understand where the question lies. And what I'm going to tell you now can be applied to discussions in science and discussions in politics, and especially in evolution. This is a point of logic which many people are confused about, and you have to be very clear. Suppose I ask, what is a table? And someone says, listen, God created the world. He created everything. And he created tables too. Tables are created by God. All that is true. But it doesn't answer my question. My question wasn't, where do tables come from? My question wasn't, who's responsible for the existence of tables? My question was, what is the table? What is it? That question is independent of where it came from. Indeed, often, if you want to know where something came from, it's crucial to know what it is. If it's dead, it may come from a factory. If it's alive, it didn't come from a factory. Because it wasn't produced out of raw materials from a factory. It came from another living thing. So it's very important to know what the thing is before you ask where it came from. Now, what you said about nature 90 seconds ago, I think is exactly right as an account of where it came from, according to these people's position. That doesn't tell me what it is. There are laws set up. Rodessa wants to know, what are the laws? Not which things are law, which particular statements are laws, but what does the law say? What does the law describe? Cause and effect. Well, yes, what is cause and effect? In particular, how does the effect come out of the cause? When you answer that question, if you answer that question, then you say, you know how the effect comes from the cause? Because of ABC. Then we'll say, oh, so that's what God created. God created ABC, and through ABC he created cause and effect. I'll go back and I'll say that God did all of it. That's quite right. But I don't know what he did. I'm asking about what he did. We all agree God did it, but what did he do?
Scientific-wise.
Oh, I didn't get to science yet. So now, Rav Desta says, when I look at cause and effect, and I ask, how does the effect come from the cause? All I get from the people I'm asking is, well, that's the way it always happens. That's the way it always happens tells me when they say cause and effect, all they mean is things that always happen that way. That's not a direct answer to my question. My question was, I put it the way one of my teachers put it, when you talk about cause and effect, are you analyzing inside? You have this cause and this effect, and you're looking more carefully, microscopically, what's going on here? Or are you taking this case and relating it to other cases at other times and other places? You're not looking inside, you're looking outside. To say that that's the way it happens always is to look outside. Gosh, I have this event and then that event. Let's look around in history and in China. Does it happen that way or does it happen that way? I'm not looking inside this case. I'm looking outside to see whether there are similar cases. Rav Desta was starting for the inner look. I have the cause, I have the effect. What's going on inside? Can we take apart the pieces and see how it works? And at the end, the answer I get is that that's the way it always happens. Then I've given up on the inner analysis. I'm only looking outer to connections to other things. Now let's go back to your question. Talking about how things grow. That's because you're looking at the plant and you're looking at the ground, you look at the water and the sun. We know much more than that. We know the plants are made of cells, and the cells take in nutrition, and they behave in certain ways, and they divide. Look at it under a microscope. Okay, let's see. Plant growth is the division of the plant cells. I look at the microscope, and I see cells are dividing. Dividing regularly. Sunlight has a big effect on the division of the cells, so does the nutrients that come up through the roots. What do I see? If I put the seed in the ground under the right conditions, then the cells divide, and then the cells change. Some become bark, some become leaves, and some, right? So what do I have now? I have a lot more information about what is going on. What's going on? Not just that the thing is getting bigger. I know how the little pieces look, and I know what's going on. They're dividing, and they're changing. Does this tell me how the effect comes out of the cause? Or does this just give me more information about the various causes and effects that are going on? Can't I ask my same question over again? The cell takes in nutrients, it gets bigger, then a new cell wall develops and the nucleus reproduces and divides. That's what happens. My question isn't, what happens? My question is, what makes it happen? How does it happen? Why does it happen? Isn't this just more stuff that always happens? Can't I ask, well, but what makes the cell? What makes the cell divide the way it does? So now let's go down another level. They'll say, listen, it's molecules, my friend. molecules have certain properties, they have certain forces that are involved in the way they operate with one another, they interact with one another. Yes, siree, molecules have all these properties, all these interactions. So the cell dividing is really a gigantic choreographed dance of molecules. And if I ask, what is it that makes this molecule interact with that molecule in that way, you'll get the same answer. Well, that's what they do. I mean, every time we look, we see that they do this over and over again. So you're back to, that's what always happens. And you go down to atoms. You go down to particles. Take two particles, two electrons. What happens if you push two electrons together? Well, they're both positive. They're both negatively charged. Like charges repel. The closer they get, the harder it is to push them together. That's a fundamental property of electrons. Right? So you ask, well, but why do they push each other apart? Why do they push each other apart that hard? Why don't some of them attract one another? What's the answer? Look, we've been looking at electrons for 50 years, and we've been experimenting with it for 50 years, and that's what they always do. What you get is more and more information about what they always do. You don't get a new kind of information about how they do it or why they do it. All you get is, these things always do this, and, you know, these things are very small, they're building blocks, and the big thing does what it does because these things always do what they do. But the kind of information you're getting is always the same kind of information. More information about what things always do. You never break out of that category. So Vesta will tell you that the answer to my question, how and why does it always happen that way? You're never getting to that. You're never breaking. I'm asking for information in a different category. And you're not providing me with information in a different category. You're just providing me with more information in the same category. Which sounds like you're bankrupt. It sounds like you haven't got any answer to how and why it happens. You just have lots and lots of information about what always happens. Yeah.
I think the answer that would be gotten back would be that before we knew the hands and molecules, we just send water and it comes out. Now we know the hands and molecules and now we're getting down to electrons. So you give another 100 years. You know what I mean? It keeps getting explained more deeper and deeper.
Okay, this is very important. Let me repeat it for the recording. You say, look, we are certainly making progress in our scientific description. We're getting more and more information. It's getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Maybe in 100 years, we'll get the answer to Rav Dessler's question. This is very important, and I'm glad you asked it because I may have created a false impression. I didn't mean to belittle this extra information. This extra information is very, very important. It's more information about what always happens. And knowing what always happens is very, very useful. That's how you come to be able to control the world. If you know what always happens, so you say, well, if I want a B, if I do an A, I'll get a B because that's what always happens. And I didn't know that. And now I know that. You know, you climb a mountain and you see that the boiling water in which you put the raw egg doesn't hard boil the egg. The egg comes out soft boiled. And that's very surprising after 5 minutes of boiling. And then you understand that it's the difference in air pressure on the mountain versus the sea level. From that, you can create a pressure cooker which cooks your meat in half the time. Because as you raise the pressure, the temperature of boiling water goes up. And instead of the water boiling at 100 degrees centigrade, it boils at 200 degrees centigrade. That's extremely useful because now I know that the boiling temperature of water depends upon the air pressure. That's very useful information. But Augusta's point is, it's very useful information, and I get a deeper and deeper explanation of what's going on, because I know a lot more about what's going on. But all the information is the same category. If science is going to carry on in the same way, it's just going to give me more and more information in the same category. More inner steps between. Doesn't tell me how and why the cause the effect comes out of the cause. It just tells me more and more structure in the cause, more and more structure in the effect, and I can predict much more accurately the conditions under which these things are going to happen. Right? It doesn't get me this new category of information. You with me? Now, here's an interesting objection that I came across. It wasn't written to Rav Dessler, but an interesting objection to his idea that I came across in a philosophy paper a long time ago now, maybe 20 years ago. As this is a shocking idea because it's written, as far as I know, the author of the paper is a non-Jew, and it's written in a general philosophy journal, and his example is this. the temple in Jerusalem. Imagine that when the temple is rebuilt, every year, on the first night of Passover, the temple rises 100 meters into the air and stays there for 3 hours and then floats down to earth. Suppose that happens every year on the first day of Passover. Every year. Suppose that happens for 50 years, 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, 300 years, 1,000 years, right? Is there any point at which you're going to say it's not a miracle? Just because it happened over and over again? Just think intuitively now. Wouldn't we say, every year you want to see a miracle, go to Jerusalem and look at what happens in the temple. Good. So it's a miracle. Good. That's what I want, right? What did Rav Dessler say? Rav Dessler said the difference between nature and miracle is just that which happens all the time. Now that was this author's imagined example. But we have on record a counterexample. We have it in the Mishnah. Doesn't the Mishnah say that there were 10 standing miracles in the temple? In the first temple anyway, according to Tosfos. That happened all the time. All the time these miracles were taking place. You have the smoke going up from the altar, and the wind is blowing, and it's a storm, and the smoke always goes straight up. You have blood and guts and meat. There were no flies. Everywhere else, I can remember when I was a child going into places where there were meat, and they didn't have screens. In other words, everything was covered with flies. Everything, everything. And here you have a giant abattoir, and there are no flies. So, aren't these? I mean, the Mishnah calls them standing miracles. How can Rav Dessler say that if something happens over and over again, that it's not a miracle, it becomes part of nature? That's one type of objection. Here are things which happen over and over and over again, and we're going to call them miracles. You have the opposite also. Suppose an event happens once and only once. But suppose, in this case science, can discover that there are various forces working against one another, and on that one occasion, the forces were balanced in a particular way and gave rise to this effect. And that's why it happened. Imagine that we live on a planet where the heat of the planet underneath is dying, and it's circulating, and there's one weak spot on the surface, otherwise the surface is quite solid, and on one occasion, the hot currents all combined under this weak spot, and you had like a volcanic eruption. And there's only once in the whole history of the world. Isn't it possible that people, through analyzing what's going on in the lower parts of the earth, would say, well, you see, I'll explain to you why it happened. It happened because you have this circulation, and the circulation has a certain amount of random combinations to it, and there is this one weak spot on the surface, and on this occasion, circulation brought all the hot currents under this weak spot, and that's why it exploded. It'd be a single event without any similar events, and yet you'll be able to explain it. And you would not regard it as a miracle. So how can Rav Dessler say that miracle means that which happens regularly? Miracle means that which happens uniquely, and nature is that which happens constantly. Now, a first move here, but this isn't going to work 100%, a first move here is, well, it all depends upon having a scientific explanation. But let's think about the growth of grass. 500 years ago, when they didn't have a clue as to how grass grows, did they regard it as a miracle? No. So the difference can't be, this I can explain scientifically and that I can't explain scientifically. I think the difference is something like this. We have a picture of how natural processes operate. And when an event takes place, we ask, can this event be explained by what we think of as natural processes or can't? Even if I don't have the explanation. I don't have the explanation. But given the way I understand natural processes operate, can I imagine getting some kind of natural explanation? If I can imagine it, even though I don't have it, if I can imagine it, then I'm going to call it natural. If I can't imagine it, then I'm going to call it a miracle. And these natural processes, they are regular. They're things that happen regularly, even if I don't know what they are. But their chief characteristic is that they happen regularly. So now, how do I look at the grass 500 years ago? I don't know why it grows, but look, it always grows, and it always grows under these conditions. It grows for good people, it grows for bad people. If it flies in the wind, it will grow spontaneously. So something regular is producing it. I don't know what the regular thing is that's producing it. That's true. But it's clear that something regular is producing it. The temple goes up into the sky. I want to know whether the kinds of regular patterns that I think of as natural could be combined to explain this. I'm very skeptical. After all, don't forget, it's not the same day of the year. In terms of the physical year, it's not the same day of the year. It's our lunar solar year, which is a different day. Even if it is, it would be right. It would be shocking. Here, I don't have any hope for discovering that, every year at this date, the air pressure changes. And, there's some kind of circulation of the wind it's not in the cards that you're going to get an explanation like that. What was the other? Right. So it's not that this event is regular, it's rather that I think that, thank you very much, that this event could be explained by the underlying regularities which make up my world, even if I don't know what they are. On the other hand, if I think they can't be explained by the underlying regularities, then I'm not going to accept it. Now let's take Professor's example. Suppose there were resurrection regularly. Every 10 years, the body regrew. So I think we would look like at that, as he says, like the growth of the grass. Something's going on there. Something's making it happen. Okay, it's very mysterious. But it happens regularly. It happens to everybody. It happens to good people and bad people. People who die young. People who die old. People who die of various different causes. It just happens every time. So then there's got to be something which is producing it, even though I don't know what it is. Take, for example, how people looked at the shining of the stars 2,000 years ago. That, from their point of view, was utterly unnatural. First of all, everything that makes light in our universe, in our world, where we live, gets used up. It doesn't make light and make light and make light and make light and then keep going without any change whatsoever. From what we know about what regular processes there are, they didn't have a hope of explaining it. Now, as a matter of fact, it turned out that they were wrong. They didn't have an idea of the underlying building blocks of nature and what the regularities were, so they got that wrong. But we know that now also from the building blocks that they have, right? It means that our observations were misleading as well. That's quite correct. But the question is, what's the idea? When we say that something's natural, or we say something miraculous, what do we mean? When we say that it's natural, what we mean is we have a conception of the kinds of things that are natural, and we say this is a product of the kinds of things that are natural, whether it happens regularly or it doesn't happen regularly. And when I say that it's miraculous, what I mean is this isn't produced by the kinds of things that are natural, whether it happens lots of times or doesn't happen lots of times. I think that's an accurate way of putting what Rav Dessler is saying. And I think at that point, you're not going to find counterexamples. Are you with me? Yeah.
I think by a temple, the fact that it's happening in one place, or in one unique place itself, would show it as a miracle. You might see something with atmosphere over there.
Think of my example of the volcanic eruption. I showed you how you can have a unique event that only happens once in the history of the world. And you could still say that it's natural because there are the kinds of regular natural processes under it that can explain it. So the fact that the event is unique doesn't mean yet that it's a miracle. It depends upon what's underneath it. What's underneath it that could make it happen. Yeah.
What is it that Tesler trying to answer to people that say that what, that the entire thing is nature in the first place, that God created a world? What's he trying to answer? If you can repeat like what you said right when you started.
Okay, the target here is this. We're starting with the assumption that God created the world. And that everything that happens in the world, aside from free will, is God's production. Question is, what did he create and how is it his production? What did he make? One picture is God made the laws of nature, and the laws of nature operate on their own. And the other, so now he says, I'm challenging you. You say he made the laws of nature, I want to know what the laws of nature are. You say it's cause and effect, I want to know what cause and effect is. If all you can tell me cause and effect is, all you can say about it is that it's what always happens, and you agree that God is making the world, right? Everything is responsive. So then, aren't you left with the idea that he makes each thing happen directly?
He decided then that from now on it's going to always happen.
He's decided then from now on it's going to always happen. What's the it?
Nature.
Now we're back to where we started, right? Did he make something that operates on its own? Or is he
created that atom that's going to always multiply?
The question is, what does it mean when you say that it's going to always multiply? Do you mean that it multiplies by itself? Or do you mean that he's committed to a pattern of making it happen that way?
That it happens by itself.
Well, then that's where Rav Tesler asks, what could you possibly mean by saying it happens by itself? You say cause and effect. When I press you to explain to me, what do you mean when you say it happens by itself? All you tell me is, well, that's the way it always happens. That's not a description of
it. You made it that it's going to always happen like that.
This is mamish parallel to this debates in evolution. Let's see if I can explain to you what I mean. God made it that it's always going to happen like that. Of course, you could use those words and say, I don't know how. I'm not responsible for that. He just did it. It's God, right? God's all powerful. He can do as he can do whatever he wants. If you had a source saying that, I think I would be sympathetic to you. If you had a verse or a Mishnah or a statement of the Rambam saying that God made it that it should carry on by itself and without his causing it, then when I ask what is cause and what is effect and I don't get any answer, I would simply say, so I don't understand what God's doing. My limited understanding, my limited intelligence, I can't understand what God's doing. But we don't have any source for that.
So your answer is saying that based on the fact that we believe in the Torah, and the Torah does say I'm chashur to
the Torah, no, I'm not going that route either. I'm not now using the Torah statement that God renews the world of creation every moment. I'm not using that either. I'm starting with the fact that God created the world and God is responsible for everything that happens. Blank. Now, how does that work? Now, I'm looking at the world and trying to figure out how to describe how that works. Someone says to me, on the basis of his own thinking, there are laws of nature, cause and effect, it works by itself, and God just set it up to work by itself. He doesn't have a pasuk for that. He doesn't have a mishnah for that. He says, on the basis of his own thinking, I know what laws are, I know what cause and effect is. God set it up, the cause and effect should carry on. Okay, but it's worse than that. It's not the question of knowing which is right. The question is whether one of the descriptions says anything. After all, we don't have this from a pasuk. We don't have it from a mishnah. I'm not forced to accept it even if I don't understand it. The person is offering it to me on the basis of his understanding, he thinks. So I'm questioning his understanding. If the source for this idea...
If you don't have understanding otherwise, then why should he be wrong?
It's not a question of right and wrong. It's a question of, are you saying anything?
So
it could be, let's analyze his words and see if they have any sense. Question is now not whether it's more primitive than that. If a person says, I have a blah. So unless he tells me what blah is, he hasn't said anything. Right? I have one, but blah doesn't mean anything. Then he hasn't said anything. It's just a joke. Right? I hear words. The person tells me words. I want to know what do the words mean. Right? He says, B happened because A caused it. So I say, well, what do you mean when you say A caused it? Hume's way of putting it was, I mean there's a necessary connection. A made it happen, forced it to happen. Once A happened, B couldn't have been different. B was necessitated by A. All those words. So Hume said, look, I'm watching the world operate. I see A happen, I see B happen. Now you tell me, that's not all that's going on. It's not just that B happened, and then A happened, and then B happened. It's much more than that. But more than that is that A made B happen, forced B to happen, necessitated B happening. You're really telling me three things are in the picture. A, B, and the glue. The purple fuzz in between. The electric spark in between. Said to him, I'm sorry, in my world, I don't know about any electric sparks or glue.
Science, God created science.
Science just tells me, this is where we were before, science just tells me more of the things that happen. So I know more and more things that happen, sort of learning about mercury, the substance mercury, and learning about cotton, and learning about flax, and learning about seawater, and learning about fresh water. I learn more and more facts about the things that happen. That wasn't my question. My question wasn't, what happens? My question was, what's making it happen? And you give me more information about what happens. It's in the wrong category. It's not breaking out of the circle of more stuff that happens.
So what we're left up here is that right now we don't know either way, in the sense of it could be God did create the world, that it, right then and there, that this should always happen from now on. But by the fact that we don't have any proof to that, therefore we can't say that?
No, that's not the point. It's not a question of proof. Suppose, I'll try again. I really should think of a better example. Suppose somebody says, this sentence comes from Noam Chomsky. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. True or false? It's 50-50. Who knows? Have you got an argument one way, an argument the other way? The correct response is, you're talking nonsense. I can't say it's 50-50. If you can't prove it, then maybe it's true. What's true? It's just nonsense. It's words that don't make any sense. Now, that's the position we're in here. You say, what does it mean when you say the cause forces the effect, it necessitates the effect, produces the effect? What are those words describing? What do they mean? I look at the world. Hume's challenge, maybe I'll go over this again the next time, Yes Hashem, but Hume's challenge was, take a stone. You throw a stone against the window and the window breaks. Right? So you tell me. There are three things going on here. The stone hits the window is one. The window breaks is two. And there's the stone forcing the window to break. That's the third thing. It's not an accident that the window broke. It made it break. So Hume says, this making it happen, can I see it with my eyes? Suppose I videotape it and I play and I go each frame. I've got a very good videotape. It takes 50 pictures a second. If I take each frame, is it that at a certain point in one of the frames I'll see the purple fuzz? You know, that sort of binds them together? Of course not. What you'll see is the stone comes in contact with the window starts to bend. And it bends, and then it starts to splinter. All you see is what's happening. You don't see any forcing, making, necessity. So and Hume says, well, maybe you could figure it out with logic. No, of course not. If you've never seen a window break under a stone, and somebody tells you there's a stone against the window, you wouldn't have a clue what was going to happen. Hume says there are two ways to know things about the world. One is with your eyes, and the other is with your logic. And if you can't find the purple fuzz with your eyes, you can't find it with your logic, it ain't there. That's the way Hume argued it. And Rav Vester is really taking that argument and presenting it in a direct and simple fashion. And that means, according to one way of reading Hume, he said, all you have is, it always happens that way. But the glue in between, the forcing, the necessitating, the making it happen, the producing, you don't have that. So give it up and be honest and face it. All you have when you talk about cause and effect is, that's the way it always happens. Now, this is all philosophy, right? Because that's where the guy started from. He said God set it up to work on its own. He said it on his own. He made it up. So I analyze that and I say, I'm sorry. I have no understanding of what it means to say it operates on its own. That being the case, what I'm left with is all these things happen and they fit into patterns. When stones go against windows, they break. When pebbles go against windows, they don't break. When the wind blows against the window, it doesn't break. Unless it's a hurricane, then it does break. I learned from experience the things that happen in the world. But now, if God's producing all these things, there's no way to describe it that He produced it at the beginning. What you say is, He's producing it moment by moment. Anyway, we'll go back over that to the conclusion next time, musician. Because we're fighting with people who think that they have an obvious logical position. Obvious. Doesn't meet any
so
more.
You're trying to defeat them with logic, not with...
That's right.